You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 23rd of May 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up on today's programme, the Thai military consolidates its hold on power a day after announcing a coup d'etat in the country as former Prime Minister Yingluck Shinawatra and the deposed government are detained. We'll discuss that and more of the day's news with Jane Kinnamont and Stuart Purvis. Also ahead, we'll meet the Iraqi short story writer Hassan Basim, winner of this year's Independent Foreign Fiction Prize.
If you want to understand what happened in Iraq, it's not enough to watch news or read a newspaper. Literature is a great way to understand.
And before the end of the programme...
Coaches, a father, coaches, a mentor. Coach has great power on the athlete's life.
We'll bring you the latest talking points from this year's Cannes Film Festival. All that and more to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So lots coming up here on the next hour on Midori House. But before any of that, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the latest news headlines.
In Thailand, hundreds of people have gathered in central Bangkok today to protest the military coup. The protesters urge the military to step down and hold democratic elections as soldiers try to disperse them. Thursday's coup has drawn widespread international criticism from the United Nations and countries, including France, Germany and the United States, which has frozen $10 million in bilateral aid. The Philippines has imposed a temporary travel ban on any new migrant workers travelling to Thailand. Their foreign affairs spokesman, Charles Jose, called for the violence to stop.
The Philippines supports a peaceful resolution of the present situation. The Philippines likewise hopes for an early return to normalcy consistent with democratic principles, the rule of law, and the will and interest of the Thai people.
Just 2.5 years after Belgium set a world record for the amount of time it needed to form a government, the risk of another post-election crisis is looming on Sunday as the country votes in a general election. A party that wants to split Belgium, the New Flemish Alliance, is forecast to emerge as the principal winner. It has proposed transforming Belgium into a loose confederation of linguistically distinct regions, giving more power to Dutch-speaking Flanders. The official spokesman of the World Uyghur Congress has expressed shock over a deadly attack in China's Xinjiang region. Alim Setov was speaking after at least 31 people died when explosives were hurled from two vehicles which ploughed into an open market in the capital Urumqi. Mr. Setov said the attack was a wake-up call for the Chinese government to address inter-ethnic issues in the troubled region.
If China really wants to have peace and stability in our homeland, East Turkestan, Tibet, and Inner Mongolia maybe, and other parts of China, the government should sit down with the oppositions, with the Uyghur leaders, Tibetan leaders, and Mongol leaders, all those who were affected for 65 years, to sit down and find a peaceful solution.
The United States Trade Representative on Friday has applauded a U.S. victory in a World Trade Organization case against China over duties imposed on imported American cars. China said that U.S. carmakers, including General Motors and Chrysler, had received government subsidies and dumped their vehicles into the Chinese market, which harmed China's auto industry. But the United States said China had imposed the duties of up to 21.5% without following the proper processes and filed a case with the WTO. The U.S. Coast Guard says the search for four British sailors missing in the Atlantic will last for a few more hours. Officials say if nothing's found, the search will be called off at midnight local time. That's 5 a.m. GMT on Saturday morning. An initial search for the Cheeky Rafiki was called off due to bad weather in the Atlantic, but it began again on Tuesday after pressure from the men's families. U.S. Coast Guard Chief Anthony Popale says they're making a last concerted effort today.
We will always put forth utmost efforts to find and rescue those in peril at sea. It is only after deepest consideration that we suspend active search efforts. Unfortunately, we have had no sightings thus far and have concluded that none of the debris or objects located during the search have correlated to the Cheeky Rafiki.
And finally, the McDonald's restaurant chain insists that its new Happy mascot will bring fun and excitement to its children's meals, but some of its customers have said that the toothy red box-shaped character will have the opposite effect. Responses also in the media have complained that the animated red Happy Meal box, with its cave-like dark mouth and rows of large white teeth, is scary and will bring children nightmares instead of joy. And that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
So, Jonathan, has that been scaring you when you've gone to get your lunch?
You know,
I know where you go.
That's right.
He doesn't. That's wrong advertising. He does look a bit scary, this character, though. He looks very big tongue kind of behind those teeth as well.
I think those kids will be scared of that big mouth.
Well, thank you very much for this, Jonathan. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24, and we're right back after this.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Лондрис, Нова Йорк, Токио.
Лондон, Нью Йорк, Токио. Dette er Monocle 24.
Лондонист, Нью Йоркист, Токиост. Се о Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
And you're listening to Midori House, and the time here in London now is 18:06, which means it's 13:06 in New York. And joining me now with their take on the news here in the studio is Jane Kinnamond of the Middle East and North Africa programme at Chatham House Think Tank, and Stuart Purvis, Professor of Journalism at City University, also here in London. Welcome both to the programme. Now we're going to start in Thailand, where the military today consolidated its hold over the country as former Prime Minister Yin Luk Shinawat and other members of the government were detained by the nation's new military rulers. While much has been made of the fact that this is the 12th coup in Thailand since the country became a constitutional monarchy in 1932. Stuart, it's kind of worrying news in many senses, but Thailand, when it's had kind of 13 coups, seems to kind of carry on slightly unabashed about all of this. I see even here in the UK, the Foreign Office has said, be careful if you're travelling there slightly, but hasn't certainly told people to cancel their holidays. You know, trade seems to be carrying on. What do we make of this coup?
Well, indeed, the American ambassador was on the radio this morning talking of how calm everything was. I suppose when coups happen as often as that, people do get used to them. But I suppose it contrasts with extraordinary scenes as the so-called red shirts and the yellow shirts battled in the streets over the previous months and the previous time. So I think, you know, it would be wrong to assume it could continue calm. It is, I suppose, unusual to have coups in a constitutional monarchy, not that there are that many constitutional monarchies apart from Britain and a few European countries. And the king's role in all this, and the king is widely respected but increasingly frail. And so you've got the odd situation where you've got the political divide based really around a man, Thaksin Shinawatra, the previous prime minister. There's a division there. Then you've got the one side appears to be closer to the king than the other. The army come in and create a coup, but then they do occasionally give power back as well. Now, that's slightly unusual, isn't it? We're used to coup leaders who say they'll give power back but never get round to it. These people have given back power before, but were they going to give power back now until the issue of the king's life is resolved? That's going to be interesting to see.
Jane, that's a really important point. In previous coups, there has been a kind of a quick announcement that, you know, that democracy will be given back to the people very quickly. That hasn't been said this time. There seems to be some concern over the health of the king and what will happen during the kind of transition of power. Also, that there is such a division. This has gone on for, you know, over a year, the battle to kind of get the Thaksins out of power. Again, do you think this is a bit more troubling this time in that there doesn't seem to be an easy route back to simple democracy?
I think inevitably it's coming to more of a head because of questions about how long the king has left. And there's a huge amount of uncertainty. Obviously, nobody in Thailand is allowed to write or speak about the king's health because they have the world's tightest laws preventing you from defaming the king in any way, even if you're speaking the truth about him. But the crown prince, who's in his 60s, is not seen as popular. He's seen as, at best, eccentric, not somebody who's going to be able to easily follow his father. And I think the military will be quite worried about the risks to the whole institution of the monarchy.
Stuart, we think of Thailand correctly as a very kind of modern nation. You know, it's industrialized in a very simple and easy way that seems to have brought lots of people into a middle class. But why is it that this country seems so riven with all these kind of tensions all the time?
It is extraordinary. I first went there about 50 years ago, and then I went there again about 5 years ago. I just could not recognize the place. The changes were of such an enormous scale that I thought I was in a different country. And, whether you call it modernization or what, or globalization, it was just like being in many ways comparable to, say, Tokyo or something like that in terms of the degree of industrialization. But clearly there's been this fault line running through, certainly through in the last year or so, around these two, almost like, frankly, sort of tribal-like football teams with their coloured shirts and everything. So I don't sort of claim to understand the situation enough to offer a solution or an analysis of exactly how it's got there. But clearly the Western allies, the powers, will be watching nervously because they've always regarded it as a sort of safe haven. Mm-hmm. I mean, it happened to a number of Western news organizations that base their Asia bureaus in Bangkok because they see it as just a safe, convenient place to get to everywhere in Asia. If that is actually threatened, that position, then I think the knock-ons could be quite serious to the economy of Thailand.
What's, I guess, interesting for outsiders, well, confusing for outsiders, is you go there, as you say, I was in Thailand during many of the demonstrations earlier this year, and it was quite strange to see people kind of leaving their offices to go and demonstrate for a couple of hours at lunchtime, then kind of go back to work. The majority of the demonstrating seemed to be very, very peaceful. It seemed to have almost a kind of an air of like the Notting Hill Carnival about it, and the police were kind of standing back and allowing things to happen. I understand that today there have been some demonstrations saying we don't want the military, which they've allowed to kind of go on. It's been, again, kind of peaceful. It's quite a hard country in many senses, Jane, don't you think, for outsiders to kind of get their heads around what's really going on? We think of them as very peaceful, but then you have these outbursts of violence and anger on the streets.
It is hard to read. People don't necessarily reveal a lot to foreigners. And of course, it is believed by everyone that the king is very popular. But as we said, you're not allowed to say otherwise. We do know that the Sinawatras are extremely popular. Their party in its different incarnations has won every election for more than a decade that it stood in. And so there is a real question about who's going to win this popularity contest.
Now, we're going to stick with the theme of coups because there's the consequences of another one being played out over the coming days. Mm. Egypt goes to the polls on Monday in a presidential election where it's widely expected that the former head of the army, Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, will be elected to the presidency. Jane, I'll stay with you on this because I know this is a topic you're very interested in. We see again here, the West has been very slow to kind of comment on what's really been going on. It is a coup in many senses. Morsi was thrown out in jail. We're seeing that the consequences of that played out this weekend. How do you think the West should play? How do you think they should view this election?
I would say that the West should have taken a stronger line quite some time ago when the first tens of people were massacred for protesting by the military regime. Very little was said by the US or by the EU. And following that, when nearly 1,000 people were killed in a single day, that was something that had been made easier by the West's reticence. What we see again is the US has just recently resumed aid to Egypt. They're worried that if they don't give military aid to Egypt, the Russians will muscle in and sell them their fighter jets and so on. But they are basically going back to the same kind of politics that they had before 2011, as though nothing has been learnt from that time.
Stuart, how do you read what's happening? Because it seems that the West has kind of given up on Egypt in a sense. It just doesn't know what to do because it kind of backed this idea that there'd be democracy. Then it didn't go the way that everybody kind of hoped it was going to go. We're now in a situation where you see judges passing death sentences on 500 people, Al Jazeera journalists locked up for really only doing their job, it seems to us.
Well, it was an extraordinary couple of days in court with the Al Jazeera journalists. I mean, I was one of a number of journalists who met the Egyptian embassy officials in London a few weeks back to try to see what on earth was going on. And it was a confidential meeting, but I can say they were trying to reassure us that, you know, the process would kick in due course. Well, if the process that kicked in yesterday was meant to be, you know, an acceptable to anyone, it was a complete farce. You know, evidence was suddenly produced of material that wasn't actually from, for instance, Peter Gresty. There was material that said came from his phone. It didn't come from his phone. There was actually images that looked like they'd been photoshopped, and the whole thing was just a complete farce. Now, to your wider question, I mean, I think that the whole issue of the Western attitude is symbolised in Tony Blair. I mean, this was a man who wanted to invade Iraq with George Bush to bring democracy to Iraq. And so one moment we're in favour of democracy, but then when democracy goes, quotes, the wrong way, as it did in Egypt and as it did in a sense with Hamas in Gaza, the wrong side's won. We'll stick with the old gang. And I just don't see how it can, that can't be a robust policy. I mean, I guess they've now, as you said, Jane said, kind of reverted to the people they know, if like the military. They know the military. There's any other sort of, you know, the American military know the Egyptian military, so they'll stick with them. I mean, it's not a very principled position.
Jane, you know, the Western version of democracy being kind of airlifted into these countries, and we hope it's going to kind of, you know, be nurtured and take off and work. But actually, when we look at what's happening, do you think there is an argument actually that occasionally you do need strongman politics?
I think anywhere in the world, people will look for a strongman when they're living in extreme insecurity. If you look back at the time of the London riots, after just a few days of panic and anxiety here in the capital, people were telling YouGov that one third of the British public would be happy to see the army come onto the streets to handle the rioters. So I think it's not necessarily something deep in Egyptian culture specifically. They've had 3 years of turmoil. The police have basically been absent from the streets, on strike half the time for higher salaries. The economy's been in turmoil. So they're hoping that reverting to the army will fix it. What I think is interesting is that I don't see that Sisi is going to be able to fix these things. He might be able to get the streets better policed, though the police don't all love the army. But he's not going to be able to fix Egypt's economy. And I would guess that a year or two down the line, there's going to be more serious protests against him.
Stuart, do you think that it kind of makes a mockery of what we've kind of been doing against, you know, for example, Assad in Syria? Because actually, on paper, when you get down to it, you know, there isn't a huge amount of difference you can judge between the Egyptian leadership and the Syrian leadership. You know, strong man, kind of doing what he's using the military against the people, crushing, you know, the freedom of speech, turning against the media. Is there a kind of, does it become a little bit complicated to argue why we're against one and not the other?
Yeah, I think it does. And I think it's sometimes done by, you know, the friends they keep. So Syria's friendship with Iran puts them in the wrong club, if you like. And therefore, I mean, I wonder now what the Western leaders reflect on of the amount of involvement they've got into the Syrian opposition. I suspect they're regretting their decision there. Though, I mean, I don't know what Jane feels about whether they should have been more involved. And perhaps if they'd been more involved, we wouldn't have got the situation with the state of resistance. We've got all the opposition we've got now.
I mean, there is a difference of scale with Assad, the number of people that have been killed, that have been made refugees. There's no comparison, you know, anywhere else in the current Middle East. But I think the West, unfortunately, has been half-hearted. They promised the opposition regime change, but they weren't willing to put in the military might to deliver it. And that's really been the worst of all worlds.
Well, we're going to look at perhaps not such strong men, maybe slightly a few weaker men who have caused a few problems here in the European elections closer to home. But you're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck, Jane Kinnamont of Chatham House, and Stuart Purvis of City University here in London. Stay with us.
Monocle 24 is your 24-hour-a-day international radio service. Based in the heart of London, with contributions from our bureau in Hong Kong, Tokyo, New York, Toronto and Zurich, and reporters in more than 30 countries, we broadcast a mix of news, discussion, features, reportage, reviews, music and more. From retail to travel, food to urbanism, business to film, Monocle 24 has it covered.
One of the things that I would like to allude to, which is very much the kind of thing that you're doing here, is you're having this kind of discussion. But the discussion that needs to take place, where the forward thinking needs to come from, is from the brains trusts and the think tanks, and they're not doing it.
To call it an international conference, that's difficult in itself. The really difficult thing is then to start to implement the conclusions.
I was actually the last correspondent to send dispatches by carrier pigeon. It's not something I'm proud of.
There are two kinds of games. The games that uses the city
and the other kind is the city that uses the games.
Plus, our carefully curated playlist is the soundtrack to your day, stretching from Stockholm to Sydney, Brooklyn to Bogota.
It was like entering the gates of heaven.
You can hear us live at monocle.com, catch up with anything you may have missed on our Time Shift player, download our bespoke app for your smartphone, and hear it all on iTunes.
I like the sense that you just have no idea where it's going to go.
Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Well, welcome back to Midori House. The time now is 18:20 here in London. Still with me is Jane Kinnaman of Chatham House and Stuart Purvis of City University here in London. Well, Europe started going to the polls yesterday. Many of the European nations will actually vote this weekend to elect their MEPs. Here in the UK, we also had a series of votes for local elections, for local councillors. Now, it's an interesting what the polls are telling us. It seems that in the Netherlands, Geert Wilders and his right-wing party seem to be heading for defeat, while in the UK, the UK Independence Party, another right-wing party, has done rather well in the announcement of the votes for the local seats. That's 130 seats have been won by them. A really kind of interesting moment, I think, because Stuart, there's a bit a narrative going on here, especially in the UK. It seems that we've had all of these political parties, first of all, in denial of not wanting to talk about some very tricky issues, well, one of which is to do with immigration. And that's allowed this UK Independence Party to come, you know, storming through, because it's presented itself as a party that will talk about these things in maybe a not very nice way for many of us. But they have won a lot of votes, and they've. Why is it that they have done so well here in the UK, do you think?
Well, I think you're right. Immigration, particularly from the EU, it has been an issue which politicians from the major parties didn't really want to talk about. Only at the end of the last general election campaign, there was an incident where a woman spoke to the then Prime Minister Gordon Brown, and he was recorded unknowingly talking about her in disparaging terms. In other words, him supplying that the political class thought that anybody who raised the issue of immigration was somehow slightly, let's say, to the far right. When in fact, she turned out to be, I think, a Labour Party supporter. And that's what's really come out of yesterday's vote or overnight vote, because actually the parties who are losing votes to UKIP, as it's called, are coming from the right because they're being, if you like, outflanked on the right, but actually coming from working class voters in the Labour Party. And in a sense, they are the people who feel, in some areas, most upset about immigration from the EU. So unusually, the north of England, which is a kind of Labour Party heartland, has been going UKIP. Now, I think when we see the European election results, because we don't get those till Sunday, although people voted at the same time, I think we'll see possibly UKIP actually getting the largest vote. Mm. Now, that doesn't translate in a general election, which is a year away now, into necessarily them winning actually any seats under the slightly strange first-past-the-post British system. But one can expect that they will get a perhaps 20%, 30% maybe, even of the votes in the Sunday announcement. And that will raise real problems for the mainstream parties.
Jane, do you think it's a triumph for Nigel Farage and his party, or do you think it's a failure of the other parties? When you look at the election campaign, for example, of the Labour Party, who should have been storming home at this point with the Alliance parties doing so badly, it seems, in most of the polls, Ed Miliband, he had just a terrible, terrible election campaign. He came across as a bit kind of odd. He didn't connect with the electorate. Why are all of these parties doing so badly? It seems like they all dress the same, they look the same, they kind of come from similar backgrounds. There's no other kind of characters there, is there, to kind of really connect with a working class vote?
That's right. I think the Labour Party had this rather pathetic party political broadcast that picked on Nick Clegg and called him the incredible shrinking man and then caricatured the Tories in the kind of crudest possible terms. What I thought was fundamentally problematic with that negative campaigning approach is that it didn't give you any reason whatsoever to vote Labour. It just made you think, God, politicians are pretty awful, aren't they? It's difficult to remember many things that Ed Miliband has said that have been convincing. He has latched onto the cost of living crisis, which is something that finds resonance with people. But what is there to offer in terms of policies?
We're going to move on. We have one more topic to kind of cover today before we get to the half-hour point. And unfortunately, I lose both Stuart and Jane. We're going to talk now about the visit of the Pope to the Middle East. Pope Francis, it's his first visit to the Middle East, and he's going to visit Jordan, Israel, and the Palestinian territories. Stuart, he seems to be not kind of playing the game as it's always played. He's obviously going to kind of do his bit to kind of say nice things about Israel as well. But he has actually kind of come out kind of in support, really, of a Palestinian homeland. Mm. Quite a brave thing for him to do you think?
Yeah, it's going to be a really interesting trip. And I suppose we can bet on one thing, is that the Israeli Prime Minister, President Benjamin Netanyahu, is not actually going to enjoy the trip. I mean, he's going to get the...
Not at all.
He's going to get, you know, the Pope in Israel. There's going to be, obviously, I think there's going to be visits to, you know, laying of wreaths at the founders of Zionism and things like that. All the, if you like, the politically correct things to do within an Israeli setting. I mean, the irony is, in the 80s, I followed Pope John Paul II around the world, and I do remember going to Latin America with him, where he publicly rebuked a liberation theologist, as they were called at the time. He stood on Nicaragua tarmac and pointed his finger at this man, so, sort of saying, how dare you be so politically active?
Wow.
And now we have a Latin American priest who, if not a liberation theologist, is somewhere towards that, going to the Middle East, and goodness knows what he is going to say. I mean, I'm sure the whole thing is carefully calibrated as to how much you can say at each place you're there. But he's more likely to upset the Israelis than he is the Palestinians, I think.
Jane, it's a really interesting point because, you know, the discussions, you know, about peace seem to have got kind of completely waylaid. Both sides kind of have kind of pulled away from the discussions in many senses. You know, Kerry has been doing his best to keep it going. He seems exasperated by what's going on. Do you think actually that the Pope has a chance here to do something quite significant to kind of reset the agenda in a way?
There is a case that religious leaders could be doing a lot more to up the pressure and to find solutions. I think here the Pope unfortunately isn't likely to win many supporters in Israel. If anything, the Israeli government will probably be alienated by his visit, but it might give some moral support to the Palestinian leadership, which is under a lot of pressure internally itself.
And you know, for you, Stuart, do you think that the Pope should be doing this? Is it the role of a Pope to be political?
Well, I think this Pope has, first of all, he's made an extraordinary impact in such a short time. Mm. And again, in a sense, John Paul II made a big impact, but he kind of, this guy's making it in kind of slightly different way. Less theatrical, I think. I mean, John Paul II was a great actor. He really controlled the stage. This man makes interesting, simple gestures that positions him in really quite clever places. So I'm sure he'll handle this well. But I mean, there's this other angle issue hanging around about, which goes back to World War II. It goes back to the silence of the Vatican about the treatment of Jews. And yes. The question is really, is perhaps this Pope going to open up the files, which will show, we know not exactly what about what the attitude of the Vatican was, but the fact that the files have not been opened before tells you there's something to hide. I mean, I think there may have been, I think it's suggested that Pope Pius XII, who was a pope at the time, may have actually hidden some Jews to protect them. But I think his silence throughout the whole Holocaust, even when it was clear in latter stages of World War II that there was a serious problem, I think that has been a real problem to the Catholic Church. And what we've seen from the other issues they've had to confront is they are just always very late to actually admit to the problems of the past.
Jane, do you feel the same, that in part of what he's doing is kind of, you know, reflecting on what's happened in the past with the Catholic Church? As Stuart says, that they've been silent on so many issues, and that he just feels that it is his role to kind of speak up now.
It would be in line with the idea of confession. I mean, it would be a brave and important thing to do. But there will be many people who are afraid of it after the church has been rocked so badly by the sex abuse scandals. There will be cardinals wondering, can we take another scandal?
Well, it's been a big news day here around the world, and we're going to leave it there for the moment. But Jane Kinnaman and Stuart Purvis, thank you very much for joining us here at Midori House.
Thank you.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
런던으로부터 모노클 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monaco 24.
位于 伦敦, 这是 Monaco 24.
Orlando, tu vai Monaco 24.
Fra London, dette Monaco 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London.
London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London. London.
This is Monaco 24.
Well, there's plenty still to come in the second half of today's Midori House. We're going to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. We'll meet the winner of this year's Independent Foreign Fiction Prize. And before the end of the programme...
Coaches, a father. Coaches, a mentor. Coach has great power on the athlete's life.
We'll bring you the latest from the Cannes Film Festival, including three great films that seem to be tipped for the top. Before any of that, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the world news headlines.
Andrew, thanks very much. In Thailand, hundreds of people have gathered in the capital, Bangkok, today to protest Thursday's coup. The protesters urged the military to step down and hold democratic elections as soldiers try to disperse them. The US Coast Guard says the search for four British sailors missing in the Atlantic will last for a few more hours. Officials say if nothing is found, the search will be called off at midnight local time. That's 5 a.m. GMT on Saturday morning. Just 2.5 years after Belgium set a world record for the amount of time it needs to form a government, the risk of another post-election crisis is looming this Sunday as the country votes in a general election. A party that wants to split Belgium, the New Flemish Alliance, is forecast to emerge as the principal winner. And the United States Trade Representative on Friday has applauded the US victory in a World Trade Organization case against China over duties imposed on imported American cars. And for the moment, that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Well, thank you very much, Jonathan. And Jonathan's going to be back in another 30 minutes with a roundup of the news today. But welcome back to Midori House, live here on Monocle 24. The time here in London is 18:31, which means it's 21:31 in Moscow and 14:31 in Rio de Janeiro. And it's time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. And today we're going to head to Denmark, and our Copenhagen correspondent, Michael Booth, joins me now on the line. Michael, welcome to the show. Let's dive straight in with the news of the police investigating a gossip magazine.
Yeah, hello, good evening. We've heard about the News of the World scandal in the UK in the recent years. Now Denmark has one of its own. The weekly gossip magazine Se og Hør is under the spotlight for some very dubious practices that have been exposed in a novel by a former journalist for the magazine. In the novel, he describes how the magazine has sources at local hospitals to give information about royal births, has a source in the Kastrup airport to give information about people coming and going from the country, royals and famous people, and probably most seriously of all, a source at one of the banking systems that has access to just about everybody's bank accounts in Denmark. This has led to various celebrities complaining and suggesting that they have been, their privacy has been invaded over the years, and you know, lots of lights going on above celebrities' heads, suddenly realizing how this magazine has got all this private information about them over the years. And yesterday, a former editor of Se og Hør, in fact, two of them, have been arrested and their houses thoroughly gone through by the police. Most interestingly, one of the major kind of hate figures in Danish public life here, Henrik Qvortrup, who is a former editor of this magazine, has been arrested, and a lot of people are rather rejoicing in his final comeuppance. He's quite a character, Qvortrup.
But Michael, just to be clear, it all began with a work of fiction then, and then somebody realised that this was kind of based on reality?
Exactly, yeah. A former journalist, and it's a very loosely fictionalised account of his life and times as a reporter on this gossip magazine. And yeah, he kind of spilled the beans in very loosely fictionalized form, and this has prompted the investigation and has revealed a lot of what he's written in this novel to be true.
Now, there's also another kind of expenses and kind of a bit of another scandal going on, which is to do with a former prime minister.
Yeah, Lars Løkke Rasmussen. He's not just a former prime minister. He's the guy everyone is predicting will become prime minister next year in the general election. He's the leader of the Venstre Party, which is the equivalent of the Conservatives here in Denmark, ousted by Helle Thorning-Schmidt at the last election, but leading the polls, or he was, and his party was up until a couple of days ago, when it was revealed that his party has spent 150,000 kroner on clothing for him, which he has then snuffled off into his own wardrobe, and it's become kind of a Y-front scandal, basically, because included in the list of clothing that he's decided to co-opt are underpants. So you can imagine the headlines, and people have really enjoyed the fact that the former Prime Minister, leader of the most popular party in the country, is taking clothing. I mean, the people may say, well, it's party money that's been paying for his suits and shirts and underpants. But, of course, political parties receive taxpayers' money in Denmark. Plus, he was supposed to have declared all of this on his tax returns, and there's some doubt as to whether he's done that. And it comes in the wake of quite a few other times when Lars Løkke Rasmussen has been caught with his chubby little fingers in the till with first-class flights and flights for his family to holiday resorts and all this kind of stuff. So a lot of mud's been thrown at Lars Løkke, and a lot of it is now starting to stick. And, of course, the timing couldn't be worse for him and his party with the EU elections on Sunday.
And, Michael, tell me, do people feel that it will kind of hit him, you know, where the votes count? And do people feel that, you know, his chance of becoming PM has been dented by this?
Absolutely, absolutely. His ratings have plummeted, the party's ratings have plummeted, and it's best news of all for the far-right party, the Dansk Folkeparti, which is, as with the right-wing parties in the UK, leading the polls in the EU elections. And it's thrown Lars Løkke Rasmussen's leadership into doubt. Waiting in the wings, most intriguingly enough, is Anders Fogh Rasmussen, former Prime Minister, soon to be ex-head of NATO, who is of the same party, Venstre. Some people are saying, well, maybe it's time for him to return from international statesmanship to lead his woe-begotten party back to power.
Now, we were just talking at the top of the show about the right-wing parties around Europe and how they were faring and what the kind of, you know, the expected outcome of the various EU votes were. Can you just tell me quickly, we don't want to dwell on it too long, but in Denmark, is there a right-wing party that's expected to do well this time?
Absolutely. A very similar model to UKIP in the UK. As I said, the Dansk Folkeparti, the Danish People's Party. Their candidate, Morten Messerschmidt, who is currently in the EU Parliament at the moment, has been sitting there for the last term. He won last time by an absolute landslide, the biggest personal vote in Danish history, I think, in an election. He's going to win again. He's going to win most of the votes again for him and his party. So, yeah, Denmark very much joining that anti-EU movement within the EU.
Now, you often write about food and drink for us and for many other people, and there's a story here that you've picked out, which is the opening of the Copenhagen street food venue.
Yeah, I mean, Copenhagen, of course, famous around the world for the new Nordic cuisine and pioneering in local and seasonal, all that kind of stuff. Not so well known for its street food, with good reason, because just about all they have here has been hot dogs or pulser up until the opening 2 weeks ago of this quite intriguing new indoor space, actually, called Copenhagen Street Food. It's an old warehouse that used to house newspaper print on a little island in the center of the harbor, just across from Nyhavn. Many people to Copenhagen would know the area. Very central. But they've taken this old warehouse and installed little caravans and old shipping containers turned into kitchens. So now, at last, you can buy authentic Mexican street food in the middle of Copenhagen, Cuban food, French food, and, of course, hot dogs.
Well, Michael, thank you very much for joining us with that rather tasty final morsel there. That was, of course, Michael Booth, who's our man in Copenhagen, and a very good man he is indeed, too. Well, up next, we're going to have the winner of this year's Independent Foreign Fiction Prize, which was awarded last night. Stay with us.
You're listening to Monocle 24, broadcasting from Midori House at 1 Dorset Street, London, W1. Monocle 24 is a wholly owned subsidiary of Wynn Content and is edited by Tyler Brulé and Andrew Tuck. With bureaus in Tokyo, Hong Kong, Zurich and New York, Monocle 24 has over 50 editors and correspondents filing for us around the clock. If you have any editorial, distribution or advertising queries, please email us at info@monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Well, welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. The great and the good of foreign language fiction gathered in London last night for the annual Independent Foreign Fiction Prize. The top prize went to Hassan Blasim, an Iraqi author who was recognised for his second volume of short stories, The Iraqi Christ. Well, a short while ago, Hassan Blasim came to Midori House and explained to me some of the stories included in his prize-winning collection. Hassan, thank you very much for coming in to see us, and congratulations on the prize. Tell us how much this means to you as a writer.
It's a great news, really. And I think it's not news just for my writing, just for my book. Also, I mentioned it's good news for Iraqi literature and Arabic literature. For a long time, we try to translate our literature to other language, to in the West and other country around the world. So I think it's a great support to my project to keep writing.
Now, we know much of what's happened in Iraq through journalism and through photography and through television. But as you say, in the West, perhaps, we haven't really got to see what people felt about the last years in Iraq through literature and especially through fiction. Do you think this is an important way for explaining much of the kind of the grief and the heartache that still remains at the heart of modern Iraq?
Yes, of course, literature is part important to understand. Like, if you want to understand what happened in Iraq, it's not enough to watch news or read a newspaper. Literature is a great way to understand. I mean, it's not like fact, like concrete, but it's really different way because you tell the real story for people. It's not like and the media make people like number, because every day, for example, car bomb in Iraq, and in the media, what they say, what the press to say, 50 people die, and that's not enough to understand what happened there. You needed this 50 people, it's people, and everybody's different story.
And Hassan, for you, it's been an interesting journey that's taken you, you know, from Iraq. You got into some difficulties after making a film in Kurdistan in the north of Iraq, and you now live all the way in Finland.
Yes.
How difficult is it reflecting on Iraq, which must seem so far away when you're sitting in Finland, in many senses, to write this collection of stories?
Yes, it's not just difficult for me. The problem is a big problem for all immigrants, all refugees around the world. The refugee in the Europe, I call him the new slave. Before the imperialism and America go to poor country to bring slave people to here. Now slave people walking to capitalism to work like a slave. And after when they arrive to paradise, what they think is like some paradise, they go after this war, they find people hate them and a lot of racism against them. So it's not easy for all the general, all the refugee people come to Europe. And Europe make all the time make border more difficult, and that's mean more people go to die.
Now, the prize that we've been talking about, you've shared this with Jonathan Wright, who translated the book. How important is that relation between you and the translator? You know, you're widely quoted as one of the most important living writers of Arabic fiction. But here you have somebody whose task is then to kind of translate you into English. Is it a process you enjoyed or you found challenging?
Yeah, it's great what happened because, you know, it's like I tell you the story. Like I try to publish my book, Arabic book, like I send my book first for 6 different Arabic publishers and they refuse. So I decided to write all my life in the internet, and I don't wait any language to translate. And something happened. I introduced Comabres, and after work with Jonathan, and he's a great job to really, and all the time easy to work with him. And he say same. It's not difficult with you like to work. We are okay. Like yeah, and to translate to English is. Yes, it bring my work to different level and also to different reader, and I am happy with that.
And tell me, the outcome for you, obviously, is great winning the prize, but it's more important, I guess, that people pick up this book and read it. What do you want to give people as a kind of a lasting feeling after reading this book? Do you want to change people's minds politically? Do you feel it's a book that should leave people kind of questioning the past? Or do you feel it's a book that maybe should open up their eyes to what's still happening in the country?
Okay, then general literature do that. But when I go to sit writing, I don't think about any big message or to change people. It's like difficult to change mind. But in the general literature do that. They open my eyes for different problem. And talk through imagination about our fact in the life and this good way. So in the general literature, do that. But when I go to write, I don't think I want to do some big message or change people. It's just inside me, and I do writing for a long time when I'm 12 years old.
And finally, for you, do you hope that there will be a time when you can return to Iraq and that these stories can be published there and you can be a writer based back in the country?
It's a difficult situation now. I don't think so now. But all the time I keep hope something can change and I come back to Iraq and publish. But now I have many readers in Arabic country and also in Iraq through internet, because I publish all the short story free in the internet. And I editing one internet magazine, IraqiStory.com, for a long time. So people read my story, so I don't need a publisher.
Well, that was Hassan Blasim, and his book is called The Iraqi Christ, and it is a quite amazing collection of short stories. And he, of course, triumphed at this year's Independent Foreign Fiction Prize, and he was speaking to me a short while ago. We're going to be heading to Cannes in a moment, and we want to get you in the mood. So we're going to give you some music. This is French. It's Je Veux, and you know it's by Zaz. Oh, you must feel thoroughly warmed up for something French now, or slightly flambéed even, because we're heading to Cannes. Because a little while earlier, I spoke to Tim Robey. He's the film critic for the UK's Daily Telegraph newspaper, and he gave me his assessment of the top films being talked about at the event. But first of all, he told me about the event itself.
Oh, it's been an excellent Cannes, I think. Possibly it's that I've been lucky with what I've gone off and seen. Often you have a kind of choice between things. And I seem to have lucked in with the good choices quite often. The weather's been lovely, except for a couple of days of torrential rain, but in between those, it's been glorious. And I think the feeling has been that actually really very good year.
Well, let's start with one of the films that you've been seeing this week, and that's The Foxcatcher. Just tell us a little bit about this film. This is based on a true story, isn't it?
It is, that's right. It's one of the most exciting films here, and I would suggest that people don't want to know too much about the true story going in, except the basics, which is that it's about a pair of brothers who are Olympic gold wrestling champions and who were basically bribed, paid by a very strange and sinister rich entrepreneur played by Steve Carell to come and train with him for future wrestling bouts and competitions. So he sort of, this man just decided to take them on, paid for this entire training facility for them, and seem to want to kind of join, sort of share their kudos. And the story kind of gets weirder and weirder. Channing Tatum and Mark Ruffalo play the two brothers. They're both excellent. But Steve Carell really is the star of the show in this one. He takes a sort of step into this very, very kind of weird, dramatic, dark territory. You're thinking along the same lines as sort of Daniel Day-Lewis in There Will Be Blood or something like that. It has the feel of a Paul Thomas Anderson film, in fact. But it's directed by Bennett Miller, who made Moneyball and Capote, and is a very serious and skillful American filmmaker. Probably the best thing in competition, I think.
Well, let's just hear a clip from the film.
I wanted to speak with you about your future. What do you hope to achieve, Mark?
I want to be the best in the world.
I am a patriot. I want to see this country soar again. Coach is a father. Coach is a mentor. Coach has great power on an athlete's life.
It certainly sounds sinister already from that clip there. And just tell me, and Sienna Miller has a role here. Is she good?
She's pretty good, yeah. It's a fairly small role. She plays Mark Ruffalo's wife. She has a couple of good scenes. I wondered if, in fact, her role might have been slightly larger and it's been cut down. But I really thought that this came off so well, this film. And there are scenes in it that are sort of kind of mesmerizingly strange. The script is terrific. Carell is terrific. He'll certainly be a Best Actor nominee at the Oscars. And I think this film in general is a real heavyweight Oscar contender already.
Well, let's move on now to Maps to the Stars. And this film has had, I guess, quite a lot of publicity throughout the week because it's Hollywood trying to look at itself in a way, trying to reflect on the nature of child stardom, the nature of fame, how Hollywood ends up eating its own on occasion. And again, just give us a little bit of a feeling of what you felt after you'd seen this film.
Yeah, I like this one a lot. The comparison a lot of people have made is with The Player, Robert Altman's film from 1992. But the tone is very different with David Cronenberg in the director's seat. It plays like a kind of horror movie. It's much more extreme and it's much kind of more grotesque. The relationships are kind of often sort of hideously kind of unnatural. And an excellent cast in this one. One of the, I think we would say probably the best ensemble cast that Cronenberg has worked with in a long time. You've got Julianne Moore, Robert Pattinson, Mia Wasikowska, John Cusack, Olivia Williams in the kind of key roles. And yeah, as you say, it's sort of about Hollywood eating itself and also the kind of incestuous nature of Hollywood, the kind of backstabbing nature of Hollywood. There are characters who you've been sort of following and kind of you're on their side for a long time in the film, and then suddenly they'll do something, you'll realize the kind of depths of their inhumanity. It's very funny, and I think Julianne Moore is particularly wonderful in it.
Well, let's hear a clip from the film.
Where'd you come in from?
Jupiter. This isn't a very glamorous job.
I would be the most loyal, most competent, most grateful personal assistant you've ever had.
I heard a girl. Amazing.
Why is it amazing?
She was burned in a fire.
Your sister may be back. I don't know if she's dangerous.
Do you know how my mother died?
No.
In a fire?
Oh.
Well, I'm someone who'd quite happily see Julianne Moore in anything. Just tell me, she has, you know, I see she said in some interviews this week that she's based her character on lots of people that she's met in Hollywood. Do you think it comes across as based on reality, or is it overblown in the sense that it becomes a bit more of a kind of a pastiche of, you know, what it would be like to be one of these characters?
Well, it certainly steps into caricature and kind of makes an extreme leap into a kind of nightmarish version of Hollywood, perhaps in the same way that you could say Mulholland Drive did, in fact. But the kind of original seed of every character you can see is based on something quite true, and in Julianne Moore's case in particular, you feel as though she's sort of connecting with the character rather well. She's playing a slightly desperate actress who needs to reclaim some of her kind of past glories, and she's trying to get a part which her mother played once in a remake, and she's desperate for this part. She'll kind of do anything to get it. It plays out quite realistically to begin with, and then it just kind of becomes more and more extreme, gets out of control. And I really like that kind of rhythm to the film. And yeah, I think definitely a great success for Cronenberg. Yeah.
And finally, we're going to look at 2 Days, One Night, a film out of France that seems to be oddly about labour relations. Is that fair?
It's partly about that, yeah. It's actually from the Belgian filmmaking duo, the Dardenne brothers, who come to Cannes a lot and have actually won the Palme d'Or twice in the past for Rosetta and also the Child. This is their latest. It stars Marion Cotillard, who's a bigger name than they usually cast in their films. She really holds it together beautifully, I think. So she works. She's a worker at a solar panel factory who is in danger of losing her job. And the situation is that the, I think, 18 other people on her kind of particular task force are being forced to vote. Either she keeps her job and they lose this bonus they're entitled to, or they will get rid of her and get €1,000 each. So she manages to get a kind of a revote, and then has to go around kind of practically door to door trying to persuade each individual colleague that, in fact, yes, she's asking them to sacrifice €1,000, but that her needs are greater than theirs. It kind of proceeds from there, really, and the kind of setup, which reminds me a little bit of 12 Angry Men in a way, because you're kind of going from one character to the next, trying to kind of persuade them the liberal argument, if you like. It's good. It's a good film. I don't think it's quite the Dardenne brothers' kind of finest work. It just seems slightly jerry-rigged to make us feel so much sympathy for her right at the start. It's like you're practically cheering the character in the first scene.
Well, again, we have a short clip from the film.
Content, t'as foutu la merde dans toute l'équipe.
T'as dit à certains que c'était mieux que je sois licenciée parce que sinon ce serait eux.
J'ai jamais dit ça.
Tu n'as pas de cœur.
Pourquoi tu veux pas essayer? Tu dois pas te laisser faire. Faut y aller.
So, Tim, before we go, just finally tell us if you had the one casting vote for who got the best film this year at Cannes, who would get your winning ticket?
Well, my absolute favourite film is Foxcatcher, but there's an African film called Timbuktu, which I liked an awful lot, which I think will benefit more if it were to win the Palme d'Or than Foxcatcher, which doesn't really need an award like this. I feel as though Timbuktu, the film by Abderrahmane Sissako, which was the very first film that we saw here, stands out as a film that kind of could really benefit from that exposure. It's excellent. It's really beautifully crafted film, and this will get a lot more people to see it than might otherwise have done so.
Well, that was the film critic Tim Robey, who works for the Daily Telegraph newspaper here in London, although he's in Cannes at the moment, when we all like to be. If you want to know more about the world of culture, you know what you have to do? Mondays. That's when Robert Bound has his culture show. It's at 1900 hours London time. And I think he'll be in Feinfettel on Monday. He's in at the moment because we were on Germany in tour. And we had a few kind of festive evenings with our readers. But he should be back in fine form, I think, on Monday. Anyway, that's all we have time for on today's Midori House. My thanks in particular to our special guests, Jane Kinnamont of the Middle East and Africa programme at Chatham House, and also Stuart Purvis of City University here in London. Today's show was produced by Thomas Lewis, research by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Carlotta Rebello, and our studio manager was Joel Chertz. Next, after the news, is The Menu with Marcus Hippie. Then at 2200 hours, it'll be time for the Monocle Daily. This show, well, it will be back at the same time on Monday. That's 1800 hours London time. But for this edition of Midori House, it's just time to say goodbye and thank you for listening.
From London.
To Beijing.
This is Monocle 24.
Nach Amsterdam,
a Bogota,
to Hong Kong,
all around the world.
This is Monocle 24.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world-famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.